a wolf, and I was a pastor in a church for various churches and seminaries and so on for about 42 years. And I retired in January, and so I've just been enjoying things, trying to keep out of mischief mostly since then. And I originally had an agenda for this evening that I was going to ask your help on. Some of you have said you'd rather do something else that I happen to talk about. So let me just tell you what my slight agenda is. And, you know, I'm flexible. I think, if anything, I'm very flexible, so we can go where we are. The new hymn book has a burial service in it, and it makes no accounting for people like me who are going to give most of our organs away, if they're any useful anymore, after we get somewhere. And there are other people who are donating their entire body to medical schools, although medical schools nowadays are glutted with bodies. In fact, some medical schools now make you pay to get on the record, and they make you pay the transportation if you don't happen to die in the same city. And some won't even record you anymore on medical schools. They just got too many people who want to have anatomical donations of the entire body. And then we've got the whole issue of cremation. And it's not an issue with me, but the burial service doesn't take any. So I've been asked by the Ohio Synod, where I still have membership of the LCA, would I try to find out and maybe even show adaptations of what it would be if we would do that. Now, that was my agenda, but I really don't need to impose it on you. We can deal with death and dying in general, or we can move back before we die and talk about aging in general. I've got some stuff here that I taught death and dying courses for the last 15 years or so. Long before Kubler Ross wrote books, I was teaching some on death and dying, and I taught credit courses in colleges and at hospitals and for nursing home nurses. My most fun death and dying course was to take the nursing aides. You don't like that word, combination of fun and death and dying course. My most fun, I'll say it again, my most fun death and dying course, and you can figure out what I'm saying, was when I had a group of people who were the lower echelon aides, the sweepers, the housekeepers, and so on in nursing homes, and dealt with them and their fears of dying and their relationship to the dead that they found. And so that's a big possibility too. So, what are some of the things that you came thinking we were going to do tonight? And then I'll try to figure out where we go with that. Who's got some agenda you had on your mind?
I thought we might be discussing some of the burial practices and how the funeral service has been used in different ways.
Right. That's part of my agenda. That fits. If that's what you had, okay. Anybody else have some agenda?
It'd be kind of good to. Okay.
Yeah.
To look at aging, as far as I'm concerned.
Uh-huh, you'd be interested in the
aging. I'm not ready to die.
You're not ready to die yet. Okay.
I think a lot of people, they don't say much about it, but they wonder about that intermediate space between their dying and
what goes on in the time between death and
then
the end of the world or something?
The resurrection, what the Bible says or what
that
the
sort of gets into a theology thing, doesn't it? Yeah. Any others? Yeah.
I'd be interested in your reaction to Life After Life, the movie.
Okay. Uh-huh. Any others?
I thought, too, you might make some comments on things that we might be aware of where people get taken advantage of.
I did bring those two things along, which deal with that in case that did come up. Mm-hmm.
The fear of dying.
Mm-hmm.
The unknown is always the fear.
The fear of dying. Well, it sounds like we're really can deal with at least two issues that would be comfortable in the time we've got to us. First of all, the whole business of dying and the relationship we have to it in generations and who we are, which does get a little bit to the aging process on it. And then the whole business of how is it changing in our life. Let me start off by asking this question. It's not one of the questions I had planned to ask, but I think it fits with what you're saying. How many of you have been to a funeral recently? Okay, how many have been to a funeral, have never been to a funeral? Let's see if we've got anybody there. All right. Let's think. What was the most significant thing to you and your faith and your facing death in the funeral? What was most helpful or significant to you? Let's just share it, because there's going to be differences. Just like when you go to a morning service or a Eucharist here at Holden, there's a different thing that impresses you. Yes?
The way the undertaker helped us out.
The way the undertaker...
He was very nice about everything, and he just took over everything.
All right, so you didn't have a lot of anxieties about getting this detail done and that detail about Social Security and Veterans Administration and grave.
My parents already had made arrangements already for their crypt.
That was already taken care of. Okay, so that in a way was the burial process, but it also included the whole funeral.
Yeah.
Thank you. Another one?
I think the faith of the family of the one who died was most helpful to me.
They sort of set an example, you're saying, of trust and faith and...
Yeah, it was an encouragement to the wife, or the, not the wife, but the mother especially. Had a faith there that was evident.
Okay.
That was encouraging to me.
Okay, fine. And that was both... during the burial service and during the visitation and all the rest. You're putting everything together, right? I take it.
I'm mainly talking about the memorial service.
All right, it was at the memorial. That's what I wanted to clarify what we were talking about. Okay, yes?
The service that I attended for my immediate family was a celebration. It really was a joy.
Okay.
One had gone to the Lord.
The resurrection, Easter victory, which is the theme of the new burial service, much more
beautiful
than the old one.
One of the most beautiful that I've seen.
So the Easter theme was there.
What is the difference between a memorial service and a regular funeral?
Okay, that's an easy one. I'll answer that in case there are some others that have that question. Normally when they say a memorial service, it's when the body is not present. There's no casket, there's no urn with the ashes, and it may or may not happen before or after whatever interment or scattering happens. Some families have a memorial service even though they have a private burial. So that there are all kinds of combinations on that. So that's normally, when we say memorial service, we merely say there's no body present, no ashes present. And whether or not they buried is irrelevant. It could be either.
Thank you.
Okay, any others had an experience that was significant? And what was the significant part? Yes?
My brother's brother-in-law, and my brother-in-law, George's brother, died when he was 45 years old, and he knew for a year before that he was dying, and he left a message to all of us, and his message was a message of encouragement and not sorrow, and he had no fear. He knew he was going to his Heavenly Father. And though he said, though he was leaving a wife and five children, he said he would miss them, not being here in his in body, but he knew that he would be looking forward to them, meeting them in his heavenly home.
Okay. I need some clarification. He left the message. Does that mean a written message?
Yes.
Okay.
It was a written message read at his funeral.
All right, fine. I thought that's probably what you meant, but I need to clarify, because people can send a message by telling somebody or even by the way they act.
Yes.
They could send the message. I just wanted to be sure. Any others that you want to share? My former pastor in Texas had the same kind of funeral. His children and his wife and the pastor who helped conduct the funeral. It was a pure celebration. You know, all the saints were singing, and we sang when all the saints kind of thing, and that kind of celebration. And for me, that was more impressive than, and I got more out of it than some of the other funerals I had attended. It's awful hard for the pastor who's performing it to say, and conducting it, to say what's important here. Anybody else want to speak on that before I throw you two more curves, and then we'll get moving a little bit heavier? Yes.
A friend of mine, her mother died, and before she had open heart surgery, and she'd come home from the hospital and was supposedly on her way to recuperation, but evidently she felt she was going to die, and she had told my friend's brother, who was at that time 12, that she was going to die, and she just shared with him, who he was 12, and he was the only one she shared with that she was going to die, and that he should seek salvation, or, you know, mm-hmm. I guess kind of leading him to the Lord.
She made it sort of a witness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, to the young 12-year-old.
Yeah, and he was the only one she had told. You know, mm-hmm. she felt death was near.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's so many of us have gone to services, funeral services, and yet subject seldom brought up for that we seldom make a choice of songs, make a choice of verses, or something that showed that our mm-hmm. feelings.
Yeah.
Quite often a pastor really enjoys those final days or talks that he's had. He picks up some verses mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. especially appeal.
So they're appropriate from the person yeah. who's dying.
And I know our pastor admitted it so well. This is thought of. We don't want to think about it.
Yep. A lot of people try to deny it. You know, there are many books on death and denial. And Kubler Ross, the first stage is denial, whether you deny it because you've been told or whether you deny it because you don't believe it. But you're suggesting another thing that I'll just mention, and then I want to shift gears for you. And that is, a number of churches, including the pastor before me at our church, and I continued it, distribute every now and then to the congregation, plus every new member who comes in gets a 8.5 by 11 sheet, which suggests these things. What's the text you'd like to use? Do you want an open casket? Do you want a memorial service? Do you want no casket? Are you going to be cremated? What hymns do you want? Do you want a sermon preached? Do you want it at the church, at a funeral home, and so on? And so we have it. When somebody dies, you just pull it out and you see it. Then you check with the relatives, because the funeral isn't for the dead person. At least it isn't in my theology. What's happened to the dead person is in the grace of God and in his hands. We might want to celebrate. He might not have wanted to celebrate. But you and I might want to celebrate, because that's how they feel about the resurrection or about faith. So ultimately, if I had this sheet as the pastor, I have to talk to the spouse or the children and say, you know, does this sound appropriate? Now, some people say we got to follow what Daddy said, or we got to do exactly like Mother said. Others will say, no, I'd rather do this. You know, somebody might want to sing Nearer My God to Thee when he puts it down on his list, or Rock of Ages, and the children or his spouse might want to sing For All the Saints, or Lift High the Cross, or some of these triumphant songs. For my personal point of view, and you don't have to agree with me for sure on this one, I think the funeral sermon and the funeral service and the burial, if there is one, is for the survivors. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you know, obituaries are sort of, they're in most newspapers, you don't need them there, you don't need to say much about the person. I'm not going to preach anybody into heaven after they're dead. And most of the people who've come know what they have or haven't done and what they have or haven't believed, just like this gentleman said over here, the faith of the family and is more of a testimony than some sermon I might be preaching about somebody. I need to preach something else. Okay, let me throw you the first hard curve. What's the thing that turns you off most in a funeral or a memorial service or about a practice about from the very moment of death to the mourning period after the last activity that's normally connected with funerals and burials?
The amount of all costs.
The cost. Right, okay. Many people are worried about that, even though many undertakers are still, and funeral directors or morticians, some of them have different names they prefer, are very gentle, and many times they say many fine things, and they are making a living and are not exorbitant, but there are some expensive costs. There are two books that I happen to bring along, because that always comes up if you have only an hour for it. One is the public affairs pamphlets. on the funeral costs and death benefits, and the other is from the Euthanasia Society, which is a manual of death education and simple burial. And of course, all the books that were written out on the American way of death and death at any price, and those books give you the other thing. Go ahead, Karin, you have something else in mind.
Well, one of the things when my father died that was really frustrating to our family is that there were no plain caskets to choose from. No, mm-hmm. no plain wooden. They were ostentatious, mm-hmm. expensive, looked to me unnecessary. And when we asked about other things, there weren't other options.
Yeah, especially where you were living. They couldn't get it very well delivered fast, right? From what I understand from where you were living. That's one of the big objections. Of course, that's another advantage for, as you said, pre-planning.
Well, you know, we just went to the funeral home where the bodies were, and I had to do both my mother's and my father's burials, and we went to the mortician and said, we have this much money to spend,
mm-hmm.
and they must keep the service within that amount of money. So he told us where to look for the more inexpensive caskets and mm-hmm. lots of ways to cut the corners, and we kept it within that amount.
The larger the city, the more likely you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in this book, I've got a list of all the cities that have funerals for $400 to $500, if you want, and they have the list of mortuaries and morticians that will do it. Others will not because they have an overhead. Let me just use my illustration. My mother died before my father, and she hadn't made no plans, and my brother and I hadn't done any because she looked like she was the healthy one in the family, and she was going to live longer. That's how good we can guess, you know, because she had been much healthier than Dad. But we had to take a regular funeral, and my brother tried to shop around like you did or like you did, and managed to get it down under 1,000. But when we got my father's funeral, my brother had joined this society by that time, and so he kept it down to 500 because of the arrangements that were made ahead of time. Now, that's something that you can help your family with ahead of time by pre-arrangements and saying, this is what we want to spend, or even paying it ahead and saying, this is what we want to spend. There are wooden caskets that are nice. And of course, Betty and I are going to get cremated. So that eliminates the casket item altogether if you're looking at cutting costs. Cremation varies again, where you get it and who does it. Some morticians do it, some cemeteries do it, some other people are just specialists and do only cremation. So it varies.
Yeah, the cremation sometimes takes place after the body has been viewed in the casket.
Some people
and
do
so
that.
They make you feel guilty if you do not provide such as would be becoming to the dead one.
This is exactly what, in a way, happens. I don't know whether it happened with Karin or not, but many people feel guilty that you ought to pay more to show your respect for the one who's dead, whereas how much you pay has nothing to do with your love or your respect or what's involved in it. So again, the way to avoid that feeling guilty is to you do it for yourself ahead of time,
but
they can't do it.
But I think the general public then, when they would see a very inexpensive wooden casket,
mm-hmm.
they would say, well, look at those children saving all of it for themselves. And I think we have to feel about someone else then, that this is
they
the
might
right
think
thing.
That way.
And it's time we educated.
How would you handle that? I've got a couple answers
for that. The last two popes who died were buried in very simple wooden coffins that were...
They wanted it that way. They had to
But that is, I felt...
You could ask for that too, couldn't you?
Well, and I'm not the Pope or anybody close, but I thought that was beautiful. It's
mm-hmm.
very simple.
A very simple...
The point of interest should not be the tapestry.
But it is.
It's the testimony. I know.
One of the things, let me ask another. She says you can do it by asking ahead, and I agree. Suppose you haven't made plans ahead. It's very simple to do another thing. And that is, if you can say, and you're going to have just the ordinary traditional kind of service and burial, you merely say to both the pastor and the mortician, we're not going to view the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then you ask for the church or for the mortician to cover it with what's called a pall. And that's what the Pope had at later time. You cover it with a liturgical covering. And whether it's a square box or a rounded box or whether it's a gold studded box, nobody knows the difference. That's part of the church's saying we're all equal if we want to use the traditional funeral. And if some of your churches don't have it, or the mortician doesn't have it, maybe you could find somebody who will donate it. And then you don't have that guilt because of what people think. And it's horrible that we got that kind of stuff on us today about what people will think about us when we're really just trying to handle our own grief at the time.
Yeah, but I can see no sense in having a casket for just showing the body,
yeah,
and then cremation after.
I can't either. I would try to talk anybody out of that. Right. It's very peculiar. Yeah, somebody up there wants to.
There is now, at least in my town, where you can leave the casket.
Yes. You can do that here too. And you can do it all over the world. In fact, sometimes, I don't know whether you've ever been to Greece or you've been to the Holy Land or something, each village has one casket. And you get the village casket for that particular funeral. And so you're all equal, you know. You all have got the same little oblong casket, or parallelogram, I guess it would be. Not an oblong. And a parallelogram casket. And you're wrapped in a sheet. And when you go out to the cemetery, they take you out of the sheet, and not out of the sheet, but out of the casket, and put you in the burial plot. They take it back until the next funeral. And, you know, we could do that, and as you say, you have somewhere you can rent it. That's the same principle. And we'd have to hunt which mortician would allow you to do that.
And
this list, of course, we've got.
I understand. Well, I know there are two that do it in Yakima.
Yeah.
But I also understand that people are using it.
Great. That handles Karin's question very quickly, doesn't it? If you have that. If you can rent, whether it's wooden or a good wooden one or just an ordinary wooden. Yes, we got a couple questions coming. Go ahead.
New Orleans has an unusual circumstance due to the fact that they have water level about 3 feet below the surface. When we visited there, they had these crypts in a large funeral area. And it could be the family, or it could be a group, usually a family. And every burial, if you were buried there, another one couldn't be buried within a year. But at the end of the year, your remains were removed, mm-hmm, kept, if you so desired. And then this was used as a reburial,
mm-hmm,
crypt. It was used over and over. We saw as many as 35,
sure,
to 50 names on one,
right,
and it removed the cost to
the necessity, not only because of the water level but also the expense.
Yes, but here's one expense, 35,
right,
people in one place, and
mm-hmm,
and they still had I don't know what they did for a service.
Yeah, but that's what it was. A great many monasteries, for example, I visited the monasteries in Cyprus. And I visit some monasteries all over the Palestine, and some monasteries have only 8 graves, or less. So when you're number 9, they move out number 1 out and start over again, and put him in with the rest of the bones. After all, God doesn't have to put those bones together. And it's not really a sacrilege that we don't let them stay there. So there are many ways like this is done.
Will you be explaining why the Christian attitude has changed and accepted cremation?
Yeah, I mentioned that briefly this morning, I think, but or maybe it was yesterday, I never know when I sent something. My father was deathly opposed to cremation for the early days of his ministry. He was a pastor too. The primary reason was that when he was growing up in the late 19th century and in the early 20th century, cremation was done by non-churched people to try to say, we're going to thumb our nose at God. He can't resurrect me if I get cremated and get scattered over Lake Chelan. And then the fish eat me, and then Holden Village eats the fish, and then all that kind of stuff. But that was a deliberate thing, and it goes back to a guy by the name of Ingersoll, was one of the ones who pushed it. Although cremation has been done by Christians way back in the 2nd and 3rd and 4th centuries, cremation was an accepted practice. But toward the Middle Ages, we got the other side and thought of physical resurrection had to be, you know, you even had to orient the cemeteries, you know, Did you ever know that, that in some places the cemetery has to be such so that your head is toward the west, so that when you rise up, you're facing the east where Christ is coming from? You know, that's called orientation. That's what orient means, it's the east. And, you know, that was a very poor theology, that Jesus was going to raise you up that way. Just like, you know, I got to face east when I stand at the altar or something as a pastor. But these things... Now, so what has changed is that we've discovered that for several things. One is that that's not our belief in the resurrection. We don't believe that God has to put us back together again or that he has to bring us up like that. But we believe that he revivifies us, he recreates us, and it's all a whole new glorified now at the time of the resurrection. And so in the late 40s or 50s, my dad would refuse to take people who were cremated. He wouldn't even take the funeral. He would begin to do those in about the 40s, partly because it was being an accepted thing, partly because he had a new sense of what the resurrection was. His theology changed about the resurrection, if I can put it that way. Another reason was, and I think it's going to happen more and more, and that's we're worried about space. Just like you said, in some parts of the world, we're already. But look at all the ground we take up for burials and for cemeteries and for large mausoleums. This is a problem that's there. And I think that's another reason. So that about 5 or 6 years before my father died, although we didn't end up doing it that way, my father's talked about, you know, maybe I ought to be cremated. That was a long shift for him. To shift from all, not even wanting it, not even letting people be buried who were cremated or have a funeral service, to saying, maybe I ought to be cremated. My mother at that time was the healthy one, and she said, no, we won't do it that way. I don't want you. She'd say, Carl, I don't want you cremated. And of course, as I say, it's really the survivor who ought to make the choice, even though my dad had made it, so that's what ended up. But that's what the change has been about. Change is that God is the power, the funeral director and the preacher and the way you're put in the ground has nothing to do with what's going to happen afterwards. Yeah, there was a lady over here who was going to say something.
Yes, I think I've recently read, getting back to some of the various ways now that burials are being handled, and one of them is where they have the insert coffin inside, and
yes,
more fancy, and then of course at the time of burial they take the insert.
Mm-hmm. The insert coffin is either plywood or some kind of plastic, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's what I've seen. I just wanted to check with what that was your experience.
I meant to respond to your question that you asked.
Yeah.
And I guess I had a disagreement with you with regards to, you know, what the survivors or those attending a funeral really do or memorial service do want to hear. And I think those funerals or memorial services that do not relate to the person who is being considered that day and who had died, those are perhaps to me what may be the least
effective. All right, now maybe that's a good thing to talk a little bit more about. Do not refer to is the way you said it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say that. I said doesn't have a eulogy or an obituary in the service. I think if we're talking about people, and a relationship, maybe you're going to talk about the relationship to this spouse who survived and how people are related and why they're related that way. That might fit into a sermon, but you're not preaching the person into heaven, which is what eulogies usually did, trying to do that. So I don't think we're as far apart as you think. What people usually said to me when I'd preach a sermon is, it sounds like you really knew that family.
very personalized.
Yes.
With,
it's a personalized thing.
Yeah.
But it's not a eulogized thing, and I think you've got to distinguish the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Personalized might even remember the last funeral that I had of somebody that I really personalized. You know, I even thought that, you know, he was pretty impatient.
Right.
He was, and people knew that, and I knew that. But that doesn't handicap the love of God, that people have that kind of drive and that impatience kind of thing. So that's, I'm glad you brought that up. Let's try another thing about, maybe you've got something, but she was answering that other question that I had. What turns you off?
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my,
that's where you are. Okay. Go ahead.
I'd like to know if there are others who feel as I do, or if there are other communities who do as we do. After the funeral, there's I'm beginning to term it a reception.
Mm-hmm.
And I people who barely knew the person come down for what is a meal, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beginning to bother me because I noticed that the ones who are, well, some are really grieving and don't feel like staying for the entire thing. In our community, they almost have to stay till the whole thing's over, and it's an hour and a half sometimes.
Anybody want to respond? I have my own feelings.
I'd rather see the give the meal to the person before he passes away. Have a piece afterwards.
Uh huh. Okay. Anybody else has a response, Karen?
I don't know if this fits, but I did feel very much the way you did. I thought, why do people just get together and chatter and talk and call up old experiences or things among themselves and almost forget that they'd come to a funeral? And then I had an aunt die again in a small community in South Dakota, and people traveled an awful long way to come. And many people were having to travel. They weren't staying overnight in that community because it was too small. And the meal was a necessity. It was a nourishment. Now, maybe in big cities where most people come from not many blocks away, it does take on a different kind of connotation. But for the first time, I saw how needful the fact that the church women served the meal was.
That's where it originated from in the United States. There were other things that are behind it, but that's
the
basic reason.
And the other thing was, it was the first time many, many people in the family had gathered in years and years and years.
Yeah, that's a sad thing, isn't it, to say that weddings and funerals are our family reunions.
Yeah.
But that's truth, you know, that's the way life is.
It did fill that function. They wish it didn't, but it did.
Yeah. There's one other thing about the meal that I think has to be said. It depends upon how much they're avoiding the grief by just talking, and whether the grief is going to be worse after all those people pull out and then nobody comes back for a while. You know, that's a real letdown.
That happens.
That happens often. It happens often. Everybody goes away and nobody comes back for the next 6 months, and you're left there all alone with your grief. But if they happen to talk and are able to share and reminisce and talk about the impatient old man, and talk about some of those things, then it's sort of like a fellowship meal rather than a party. But you're right, many times it doesn't do that. I've been to both kinds. I've been to kinds where you wouldn't even know it had been a funeral. And the people, the children or the surviving spouse, nobody was dealing with grief, or nobody was dealing with memories, nobody was dealing with what was going to happen after they all go home. But I've also been to others where the woman who happened to be the survivor, or the man who happened to be the survivor, sat and talked to different people at different times and shared the sorrow. One of the reasons people sometimes say, I don't like visitations, and I don't want visitations myself, and I don't know whether Betty wants to have you visit her when I'm dead and been cremated. But one of the reasons for visitation is, again, to be able to repeat your story. And some people say, don't tell me again. But I gotta tell you again how she died or how he died. If that's my need, it's part of my grief work to say it over again. I've seen pastors say, I don't like visitation rites, which is okay for them to say that. And and other people say no visitation. You've seen that in the obituary notices, no visitation. Now, sometimes that's cutting off the grief work. Because if I tell the story of how somebody died, if 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 or 100 times, I've begun to vent it, and I've gotten it out emotionally. It's very helpful for me to do that. Now, I don't have to have a body present and a viewing to do that. I can do that with a cremation and people come and see me at home, right? I could just as well talk if people came over that way, and I could share my grief and vent it. It's a very important part of the whole grief work that we're doing. You look.
Haven't you got to be alert to the natures of the individuals, because one may want that and another may want a little loving,
right.
A little caring for them, for them in their position, while somebody else wants to talk it over. And some of them, I find, that want to talk over maybe a year or two afterwards.
Yes.
They want you to listen.
People's grief, we know from much research, plus your own experience, I'm sure. Some people get over in 3 months. Some people it takes a couple of years. Some people may never get over because they haven't had the help that they need from other people and neighbors and loved ones and clergy as well. Yes?
I think this is, when people refuse to have a burial service, this is something that is overlooked, the transition period. And I think people that are denied that, even though funerals aren't pleasant or fun to go to, I think it's an important function in the bereaved one's recovery.
Yeah. Whether it's a funeral or a memorial service, some kind of public grief work is helpful psychologically and, I think, theologically. But it doesn't have to be the full-blown church service funeral that's in the hymn book in order to do that. It could be some other kinds of things that are done.
Yeah, I'm just not sure what you said. You see in the newspaper, no visitation. I don't know what kind of visitation that refers to.
That means don't come to the mortuary. The family isn't going to be there, and maybe even the body ain't going to be there.
Okay.
That's what it normally means.
Don't visit the body.
Yeah. More normally, that's what it means. Yeah. It doesn't say don't come to my house.
Right.
Thanks for asking that. It's not saying I don't want to have anybody bother me. It's saying we're not going to be there for you to come and talk to us. You can call me on the phone or come to my house, but no visitation at the funeral home. Or, and some say no viewing at the church. You know, I spent the last 10 years of my life when I was doing funerals at all. Part of that I wasn't, because I was in teaching and adult education. But I would suggest, and here again, you got to have to be sensitive, I would suggest to people closing the funeral, the casket, if they had one, before the service. In fact, I would, for some people, suggest they have it closed all the time, that never have it open. But you have to be sensitive. Some people want to touch. They need to touch. Some children need to touch the hand of a father or a grandfather. It's sort of, let me use the illustration I like to use. You might not like it, maybe some of you had experience with it. It was harder for people who had MIAs out of Vietnam to conquer their grief and to know what to do with it than for the people who had their bodies shipped home, right? Have you recognized that happening? That when you've got a body and you've got the reality of it, whether you touch it or whether you only see a flag-draped casket, there's a reality factor about that that helps the real grief to come out. But when it's an MIA and you don't know whether they're dead or alive, whether they're scattered into smithereens or whether they're prisoners of war, this grief goes on and on and on and on, and there's no end to it. It's a very traumatic thing. And so that's one of the reasons why people are saying maybe the family ought to have a chance, if people die in a hospital, to go in, and that the nurses don't shut them out right away. Just go in there. And then you don't have to do it at the funeral home. But some people prefer not to see them in those conditions of, you know, we don't always look so pretty right after we die. But that's reality. That's what death is. So some say, you know, even if you're going to close the casket, come and touch and view. Even kiss if you wish. There's nothing wrong with kissing if you know, feel like it. Everybody's got to be sensitive to what's one and two. And the word talking, when my first wife died, my youngest daughter was very small. And being a garrulous preacher, as you're already catching on, and I like to talk, I thought words would help something. And as we looked at the casket and the body, she says, "Don't talk, Daddy. Talking doesn't always help. Even preachers talking, much as I hate to admit that, doesn't always help. Sometimes just silence and facing the reality of here it is." Is that?
I'm a social worker, and over the years I've found that a lot of times when people are really concerned about these big, flashy funerals, that's basically the main ingredient is guilt, because I know I've gone to more than one funeral, and I know for a fact that they haven't remembered Grandma's birthday or Mother's Day for 2 or 3 years, and yet you get there and there's red roses all over. And I think sometimes, I guess, we need to be doing what we're doing now, while there's time and while there's living,
and while
there's to be done with people. We ought to know about that, you know. As believers, it's really important to deal with that issue, and it's just so hard to know what to say to someone who didn't really do what they should have in time, because there does come in time.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that on the cost.
I think it's good you said it, because some unscrupulous, and I say some, and put the word unscrupulous, because I think we shouldn't lambast the way Jessica Mitford did. We shouldn't lambast and say all. You know, that's the stereotype, it's a generalization, it's false. But some unscrupulous people play on our guilt. And if they know the children haven't been visiting Mama for a long time, they'll work that guilt up to a higher cost casket very quickly. Many of them don't, but it can be done. It can happen. And then you've got added to that, you've got people who are insecure, not guilty, who are insecure in their neighborhood or in their social status or even about their faith or their love and whether the neighborhood, who, what will people think? Or what will people say? Which is the kind of thing you were talking about earlier about the guilt. That's another kind of guilt that can be put on.
Some people are having family services.
Yes, limited to the family.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, when my husband died, I did put it in the paper, family services.
Mm-hmm.
But people called and asked if they could come. Certainly I wouldn't say no.
Mm-hmm.
But I had preferred family.
Mm-hmm.
If I had my brothers, I would have. It is a time of grief, and it's very hard to come to terms with life at that time.
With a big crowd, right. You're saying. How about this is another suggestion that you may not have thought of. Not that I've got all the answers, but one is you have the public funeral where people can come to the church, and then you say private committal or family only for committal. And some people have found that helpful.
Cemetery. I know, I
was cemetery only.
By certain friends.
By writing that.
Why? Didn't you want people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's their problem, isn't it, really?
But it wasn't my problem.
Sure, it wasn't your problem at all. It's their problem.
One subject you haven't talked about, and I think...
Oh, there are lots of them we haven't talked about. Go ahead, let's have yours.
is conversation with the bereaved afterwards. How are you going to approach it? Are you going to be frank out, say, do you want to talk about old times? Do you want to unload, or how do you...
How do some of you approach it? You have just as much experience as I do, and because I always have a certain role that they put me in too. How do some of you?
I read something recently.
Go ahead.
It's just a real blessing to me. There had been a small town, and everybody knew this man who died, and everybody felt so bad because it was a 53-year marriage and happy children. It was just a real loss, and nobody wanted to even bring it up. And about 2 months later, this dear friend was going by the widow's house. And she thought of something and just went in. She says, "I want to tell you something that I thought about today. Your husband did the funniest thing one time." And she just told this delightful personal account about what this woman's husband had done. And the woman stopped and she said, "I thought everybody's forgotten because nobody talks about him. I needed to hear something that he did." And that, then of course, this woman shared it with other people, and it really helped that woman because the widow wanted to know that they remembered him, and everybody was afraid to bring him up because, you know, of her loss.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really...
People in death education are saying now, in addition to the meal where everybody's there and then nobody shows up, even some of the pastors don't come back after the committal. A few come back a week later, but maybe they ought to come back every month or so, or every week for a while, till they're sure things are going on. But they call this the conspiracy of silence. As if now he's written off the face of the earth, and we don't want to recall your husband to you, because what'll I do if she breaks down and starts crying now? Well, you know, if she breaks down and starts crying, that's great. It's helpful to, again, relieve some emotions and do some grief. And it's my fear of her crying, not her fear of crying, that prevents me from telling stories like that. And so the conspiracy of silence about death, after death, is a peculiar thing. And that's exactly what you're saying. She was so pleased that somebody finally admitted, gee, I'm a widow, and I did have a husband once.
And he did say funny things.
And he did
you
do
know?
Things,
you
right.
Know,
it's
yeah.
it's a very realistic way of looking at it.
I was really blessed by that. I thought that was
mm-hmm.
great.
It's a very fine story. Thanks for sharing that.
And the woman apologized. I'm sorry to bring this up, but you told me somebody had. And then it started to heal.
Now, your question is a little bit more about visiting at the mortuary or shortly thereafter, isn't it?
No, I'm concerned about the, as a friend or as
okay.
a neighbor, and you don't know whether they want to talk about it what would be your...
How have some of you done it? That was one way.
I mean,
what do you
the
think
right
is helpful?
And did this apply, did this... have to be according to the timing and the individual.
Everybody's timing is different. That's the tough part about this. You know, everybody's timing of where they are in the grief
in
process.
In other words, you follow an inner
some kind of sensitivity.
Speaking
right.
that prompts you to do
some
that.
Kind of sensitivity
to
the person that you see. Some people, all you have to do is show up. And gee, am I glad you're there. I want to talk to somebody. You know, and that'll... The floodgates will open, not only the tears, but the voice. Some people you'll have to say. You know, you might even just say something as dumb as this. You know, I've heard people say it, and it opens it up. You know, I liked what the pastor said at your husband's funeral a week ago. And she might start talking about facts. But you can't stay on facts very long if you're still having emotions in here, you know. About this, and so that's just a very simple one to do. Yes, so give us another suggestion.
Very simple.
Sure.
As a amount of people, usually, hi, how are you, is a very surface thing. But in that instance, I wonder if very mm-hmm. realistically you could say hi, how are you, and meet
mm-hmm.
and sit and listen
and wait to their real response.
That mm-hmm. could be the opening that would give. Enough of them to let off their feelings and wash away the grief and the tears with tears and unhappiness until the memories are bright and shining and where Sylvia was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Or how you doing now? It just says the same thing but puts it a little bit more bluntly. So that we're talking now. You've just gone through that not too long ago. How about it? What did you want people to say to you?
Well, the one thing that I can't understand about people now my wife passed away a little over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
We were good members and had all the and good friends in the town. And it wasn't hardly a month that went past and I was a loner.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody showed up, the phone wouldn't ring. And it's the same even today, even a year, over a year later.
Yeah. And this is unfortunately more typical than not typical. It's that conspiracy of silence, leave you alone, and really what they're saying is, I'm afraid of talking about death.
You just become a loner, and
yeah.
seem like in their kind of a society.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the reasons why I come to Holland Village.
Right.
So I can
be with people.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's very valuable for many people to come
you
to Holland.
You didn't have no children.
For that reason.
You become a loner.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't fit into their society.
Right. And the hurt of being left with the church maybe eating the dinner and
yeah.
then nothing after the dinner to, you know, nobody coming back.
Now, I've talked to others here in the same situation.
I'm sure right in this group we've
yeah.
had experiences like that.
We have in our church, and you probably noticed this too, we have quite a few widows. A number of widowers, and some of them have been through some pretty tough times. And we have that problem. What can the church people and church group do? I felt that we could have a grouping of these people with a common interest in the church.
Okay, let me respond to that, because I've got a real issue on that. I've been running widows programs for the last couple of years, but the University of Oregon, is that in Eugene?
Mm-hmm.
Eugene, okay. They have a department in their gerontology which is called the Widows Service Department. And they've got a manual, which your church ought to get, got a manual on how to establish a widow-to-widow program, which includes a widower coming to you and talking to you and keeping it up, the visiting. It also includes the kind of things, and I hate to use the illustration, but they're the ones who began the idea, and that's the Alcoholics Anonymous kind of sharing group, how to get that kind of a group. Not that it's a new matrimonial group, or not that some people won't say, I don't want to be in that, just like my mother-in-law doesn't want to be in a senior citizens group. That's all right, that's her privilege to say that. And some widows won't want to come to the group. But the care of somebody who calls, another widower, or another person who's not even from your own church, could be the community if it's a smaller town, where they do that. And it's a very good handbook. It's well done on how to do it either in a community or in a church. The original widow-to-widow program got started in Boston about 10 or 11 years ago. And very well done by some psychological people, and they train the widow. And you see, the widow or the widower who is serving is also working through some grief at the same time. You know, I've got it all made up, everybody. You're helping each other as you do this. But if you want to, write to the Widow Service Department at the Institute for Gerontology at University of Oregon. It's the best in the country for that particular thing. It's not the best gerontology department necessarily. Yeah, and then we'll go over here.
My sister-in-law has recently been widowed, and she joined what is called, it's called over there in Pikeville, Minnesota, T-H-E-O-S, FEELS. And that's what it is. It's for those recently bereaved can meet with others.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it does resemble Alcoholics Anonymous in one way. Each one supports the other.
Right.
You can call a member at any time of the day or night,
right,
and get support or help or just talk.
The thing that's sad from my point of view about this is that this had to come out of Boston, out of a social work institute, or out of Eugene, out of Institute for Gerontology, and the church missed it. You know, it's really a church love, support, sharing, encouraging function. And now I'm so glad the churches are doing it, and I'm glad I got back into it to do something like that. But, you know, I guess rather than lamenting it, let's just say thank God we're finally in doing something about it. And you haven't had a chance to talk.
No, I was just curious, your comment on, you mentioned fun when you had a session with nursing home employees and so forth. I've been in a situation in a hospital of having patients die and dealing with the immediate family with the shock and so forth. And why was it fun?
Okay, because it was fun in the sense that the people who were dealing with the ones who actually die had to deal with themselves. Because I didn't talk about theory. I made them do some fantasies about their own death and their own dying. And after they had shared that with each other, they got a big bang, and I use that word, out of what they had discovered they had been doing to people that they sure wouldn't have wanted done to them. And it was, you know, sort of an insightful kind of thing. And, you know, there were blacks and there were whites and there were Chicanos, and because it happened to be some Texas people that I was doing this with. And that's the fun about it. They saw some things that they hadn't seen before, and they enjoyed doing it. You know, that sounds funny. They enjoyed fantasizing about what they would prefer and how they would like to be treated when they were found that way. And at my retirement conferences, I run a lot of conferences. On my way back to Toledo, I'm going to stop at Rockford and run a three-day retirement conference for the Illinois Synod of the LCA. And we always do something about funeral planning 50% of the time I make people fantasize their own funeral. From how you died to what finally happened to your body. And what are they saying about you a week later? Which, you know, again, gets to be the week later stuff has both heavy and light stuff in it. Because some people who've had trouble with their children will say, gee, some of them are grieving and others of them are awful glad I'm gone. You know, and so you got that to work with. And some people can work that together. So maybe I would say the learning is fun. And yeah.
Can you back up, because you just said death and dying, I don't know if it's appropriate to get into the
sure.
before the death, to be supportive of those who are facing into it. I mean, what's their needs at that point?
Yeah, we don't have a lot of time because they're going to ring the bell for us in a minute. But there's a book by a doctor by the name of Wiseman called Death and Denial. And he says that when we don't tell people about what's happening to them, you know, that they're terminal, they've got some grief work to do themselves. In addition to grief work, they've got a lot of actual things they want to do. You know, maybe they haven't gotten a will. Maybe they haven't been reconciled to their children. Maybe they got a business partnership they ought to figure out how to phase out. He's got a list of about 18 things that people really need to do, and the doctors and nurses and families who say, we're not going to let them go, another conspiracy of silence of a different kind, we're really not allowing them to really live the rest of their life. We're denying them part of it. That's...
And then that person who's close person, I was wondering how you support that person
mm-hmm.
who has needs at that time.
Yeah, person who's alone.
No.
Or is going to be alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I might share one
go ahead.
Thing.
What helped?
It was funny. I've never forgotten it. The chaplain where I work came to me and said, I feel very sorry for you. You're too young to start, you're too old to start over and too young to be put on the shelf. And I just looked at him, I couldn't believe he was, that was his word of sympathy. But you know, it was good for me. I was serious with him,
mm-hmm.
but it was good for me.
It was a reality factor,
it
but it also
reality.
Had some of your anger.
He was very blunt,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and that's what he said. I've never forgotten it. That's the one thing I'll never forget.
A reality factor. I think the support can be to help that person to prepare. What are you worried about? What are some of the things that you're anxious about?
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is the loneliness or is it making the decisions or some of those things are will give support too. But there are a lot of things that have to be done by both the survivor and the person who's dying. Betty?
I think that a lot of people who are in the same position that you were like to be reassured that somebody knows what a burden it is to the person who's caring for the person who's dying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what you physically are going through, sometimes it's exhausting,
mm-hmm.
and everybody says, how is he? Nobody says, how are you?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's very helpful, too, so that somebody cares about you because you really run up.
And you don't mind phone calls and things like that?
Oh, no. Please
uh-huh.
do.
Uh-huh.
I need to know there's a world out there, too.
You need to know somebody else is interested
right.
in you
that's
as
right.
well.
Right.
Besides the doctor and the nurses and the funeral director.
I had